This is the State of Things live from Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stasio. Two cybersecurity breaches that exposed the private information of North Carolinians came to light last week. Mecklenburg County officials announced that county servers had been hacked. Hackers demanded the equivalent of $23,000 in Bitcoin to unfreeze data on the servers. The county refused to pay, and they're still working on getting their systems fully operational. Also, Duke Energy announced that customers who paid with cash or checks at certain walk-in payment centers may also have had their information stolen. These incidents are part of a wave of data hacks happening around the world. David Levine is a professor of law at Elon University. He's also an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and he joins us now. David Levine, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you.
Take a look at this, because really over the past few years, there's a news story every week. We found out that Uber had massive data breach, 57 million users, and wasn't telling anybody. Equifax, the same thing. So what's behind these hacks? Are they really increasing, or is it just our imagination?
Yeah, and then thanks again for having me. I mean, this is such a huge topic happening right now, which begs that question. You know, it's unclear that there's more of it happening as much as it is that we're more aware, which ultimately I think is a good thing. We have clearly, right, a growing interest in data. That's something we've known for quite a while, right? I mean, that goes back to the dawn of the information age, which I put in quotes, right? But clearly data and personal data is of increasing value, and therefore, because it's of increasing value, more and more folks want access to that data for good reasons and for nefarious reasons. As a result of that, there is, in that sense, an increasing threat to computer networks, precisely because that is where that information is stored, right? But that's different than saying that the threat now is greater, because this threat has been around for quite a while.
All right, let's take a look at the culprits in this and start with us. Are we complicit in all this? Every time I tap I agree, I've let something go for convenience sake, right?
Right, right. And so there's two ways to approach that, right? One way to approach that is to say, take a very, consumer responsibility, duty to read kind of perspective and say, look, you as a consumer make a volitional choice. You have a choice not to do or to do something. You choose to act, you choose to interact with these entities, and therefore, right, you have to deal with the consequences if things don't go the way you expected, particularly if you don't understand what you're entering into, right? On the other hand, and I'm glad, Frank, that you mentioned contracts, right, and agreeing, because we also know that there is a crisis of contract online, precisely because it's not clear that anyone's really agreeing to anything when they agree to contracts online. There's a whole body of law, and I'm a law professor, so I'm going to try to do this in a way that is both interesting but doesn't require you to be a law student, right, to follow it, right? There's a whole body of law around what it means to and how one agrees to contracts online. Is clicking a button enough? And to put it very directly, lots of entities that hold consumer information, that hold private data, have processes for agreement that are lacking. And on top of that, the terms within those contracts are often difficult to understand, are ambiguous. And so that, on the other hand, would suggest that, yes, while consumers maybe could be more purposeful and do a better job of understanding what they're doing, how much can they really understand and how much can they control, even if they did?
All right, let's take one step further into the future and say we've resolved all of those problems and then we at some point magically say, I agree means I agree, and it's a lawful and binding contract. Furthermore, you understand that you're giving away the right to this company to transfer your data. Okay, we're doing it, and we're doing it because it's convenient. So on the other hand, I think even if we knew all of that, that's because of the convenience of one-click buying and everything else that we can do, get a cab to our door in 8 seconds and not have to pull anything out of our wallet when we get out of the car, all of that means we're probably going to do it anyway.
Sure. And, you know, and that's where the issue of choice is so important, right? At one level, it used to, maybe 15 years ago, 20 years ago, you might be able to say to someone, look, if you don't want your data out there, right, just don't get on the internet, right? Don't send emails.
You're right.
And therefore, you'll control yourself. But what we see, right, and what we have seen, and that may not have been really true even then,
right,
is that your data is being held by entities and sold by entities, right? sometimes without your knowledge, right, that has nothing to do with your interaction with technology, but rather that these entities use it, right? The other aspect of that, which is very important, is something you've mentioned, Frank, which is ultimately the question of consumer choice. To the extent that I go to a local supermarket, right, and I use a club card or a discount card, right, when I swipe that card, I'm making a choice whether I realize it or not. Right. And the choice is I would like that 50-cent coupon for whatever in return for the entity selling it to me, knowing a lot more about my buying habits and what I'm likely to buy next. And like you said, some people may decide, hey, that's worth it.
Even staying off the internet, let's talk about the Duke Energy breach. Right. Those people were using cash and checks.
Right, right. And so this is where the issues get even more confounding, because one may think, right, well, I'm going to use the old-fashioned paper check, right, to transact business. And in that way, how much could one gather? But this is where another huge issue arises. And it is the third-party vendors, the entities that you don't know you're dealing with when you make that payment, that also hold your data. So in the case of the Duke Energy breach, right, it's actually a third-party payment processor that is the entity that, in fact, apparently was hacked, which raises all a host of other issues. How many folks ultimately know who the payment processor is for Duke or any other entity that you work with, right? And yet these entities are holding your information.
Furthermore,
as well.
Duke and this other third-party entity went back and forth over whose responsibility it was, and therefore it took us 10 years to figure out that it happened. Duke said, wasn't my problem. Let's talk to them, right?
Right. And to some degree, right, to be fair, it can take a while sometimes to find out that a hack has occurred. On the other hand, and I completely agree, one of the primary challenges we have, and it's a problem, particularly from a consumer perspective, is lack of notice, right? To the extent that you are not aware that there is, for example, data that is out there that you, again, may not know exactly what that data is or who has it, is out in the wild, there's not much consumers can do about it. And so finding that balance between adequate and timely notice, but recognizing that sometimes these actions can be hard to detect is one of the challenges.
But they're not required at this point. There's no real requirement for these companies to tell you, or is there?
Well, there's a general requirement, and this varies from state to state, but as a general matter, entities are required at some point in a timely manner to advise about certain breaches, right? We do not have, to be clear, right, federal, that is national law dealing with these issues. And there are legislative efforts regularly to try to do that. But as a general matter, both best practices as well as many state laws require timely, whatever that means, notice once the hack is known.
Let's talk about Mecklenburg County and what happened there. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so and this is an ongoing story, but as best as we understand, Mecklenburg County servers were ultimately hacked, and then the data itself was encrypted, basically meaning it was taken from those servers and locked down by unknown entities who then demanded a certain amount of Bitcoin in order to share the key, basically, to free that data.
All right. And tell us more about Bitcoin and why that's important and the role that it's playing in all of this.
So we have about 4 hours, right? So, okay. All right. So we'll go for a little while. So this is probably one of the hardest questions you could ask an internet law professor, is describe Bitcoin in a short amount of time. So I'm going to try to do it this way. Bitcoin is an example of a cryptocurrency. And what a cryptocurrency is a computer-generated piece of currency that has value by virtue of it being somewhat anonymous, encrypted in the sense that you're not quite sure who owns it, and its value is based upon how much people are willing to pay for it. It is as amorphous as that. The technology around it is fascinating and complex, but what it boils down to is an alternative source of making payments in a market where people decide that it has value and therefore they want it.
Which is, in broad strokes, how any economy works. We decide right. It has value. In the case of currency, it has, the government tends to stand behind it. In this case, it's because everybody agrees that's the value of it. But the value in this case is it's also untraceable.
Yes. And so as a general matter, although like most things in our society, when we say it's private and anonymous, if you do enough work, you might be able to de-anonymize it. But as a general matter, cryptocurrencies are difficult to trace because you have to use an email address, which may not be your name. And there's very various ways to basically hide not necessarily the transaction, but who's behind it.
And the fact is, we created these systems. I mean, you can break into the NSA. There's almost nothing I can do on my little laptop to keep myself safe, is there?
Well, so that's a good question, too. The answer is, yeah, there are things you can do. And you alluded to it, you know, in discussion prior to the show. I mean, to the extent that an employer, for example, and I do a lot of work on trade secrecy, on information that's valuable because it's not known by a competitor, like the formula for Coca-Cola, for example. To the extent that you have an employee that you fired who has access to information on computers, right, that are the employer's computer, and you allow that employee or former employee to walk out of your office with that laptop, you've done far more damage to your cybersecurity and control of information than anyone could, frankly, any other way.
You're describing what happened at the NSA, but go ahead.
Yeah, to some degree, yeah. and it happens more frequently than you might think. So let me give you the quick answer, though. There are things you can do. Yep. I'll give you a great one. To the extent that you're concerned about people watching you through your device, take a piece of tape and put it over the camera on your device. I do that with my computers. There is no way to hack a piece of tape remotely.
All right. Great advice. David Levine, professor of law at Elon University, also an affiliate scholar for the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, how good are humans? But before we do that, we're going to hear the music of Ann Claire Niver, who has a Kickstarter going right now. And here's a little bit of her music on the state of things.
Tectonic plates are shifting under my feet. Tectonic plates are shifting.